Howdy, and welcome to The Stoop. I'm Cutter Gonzalez, your host. Today, I'm talking with Susan Bean, who lives and works in Asheville, North Carolina. I absolutely adore Susan and her whole crew at Mountain True, and we get into some real weedsy stuff here, stuff that many of us face as we try to advocate for housing abundance in concert with our institutional values about protecting the environment, social and racial justice, and more. She's been through a big policy victory that provided a lot of big learnings, and we'll get to all that in a sec, but here's a little bit about Susan before we jump in. As the Housing and Transportation Director for Mountain True, Susan analyzes and informs their policy priorities for housing and transportation projects across their entire geographic footprint. Originally from Atlanta, Georgia, Susan earned her BA in religion from Davidson College. Following her passion for outdoor education, she next traveled out west to work for the National Outdoor Leadership School, leading whitewater paddling trips in Utah, Colorado, and Idaho. She returned to the Southeast to earn her master's in public administration from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, where she continued training wilderness trip leaders as a graduate assistant for the university's outdoor program. In 2011, Susan moved to Asheville and worked for various nonprofits before joining Mountain True as their community engagement director. After 7 years in that role, she transitioned to working within their Healthy Communities program, focusing on housing and transportation issues. She is actively involved in the community, serving as an election worker and volunteering as a facilitator with the Building Bridges program in Asheville. We've got a lot to cover with Susan, and I have a feeling this episode is only the first of many conversations we'll share. So let's jump in. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Cutter. Good to see you.
Welcome to The Stoop.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
I am so glad you're here. I've wanted to have you on for a long time, just because we love yapping, I think, the both of us. And but we also have some major, major things to talk about in Asheville, North Carolina, where you're from. And I am stoked. It's going to be really great. But before we get to Asheville, you are the guest on the podcast, and I want to know, what's your story? How did you get into housing?
Well, so basically, I've been working for an environmental policy advocacy nonprofit here in Asheville called Mountain True since 2016, and it's 2025. So I'm just realizing, like, that's almost 10 years. That's crazy. But and most of that time, I was our community engagement manager or director, and sort of helping put on education events, guided outings like hikes and I don't know, educational stuff, membership recruitment, those kinds of things. And really loved the organization and the work that we did, but got bored with the logistics of like book a caterer, find a venue, you know, whatever. And I had been working more closely over the years with one of our programs, our Healthy Communities program, that deals with things like land use, transportation, policy, and housing. And that was really appealing to me in part because partly because I'm very impatient as a human, and I wanted to be able to like help people and my community on a shorter time horizon, right? Like working as an environmental advocate and dealing with things on a scale of like climate change, you just like, you know, the work you're doing is important, but it's hard to feel like you're seeing rewards on any kind of like...
Yeah, you're like on geologic timescales. It's not as felt. Yeah.
Yeah. So I struggled with that. And so the prospect of working in an area like housing policy, even though housing policy in itself can seem like a very long time horizon for change to happen when you're dealing with policy, but felt more sort of within reach than some of the environmental policy stuff. So was excited to be there because I want to help people. Like I feel very, I don't know. It's just important to me to benefit my community and the people that I see around me suffering. And I know that there's just incredible crisis where people can't afford to live where they need to live or want to be able to live, or and there's just not options for people. And that, I don't like that. So anyway, so I got into this work because I was already sort of in this organization that did it a little bit and wanted to move into that more fully and got the opportunity to do that starting like 2 or 3 years ago now. Yeah, and so I'm our housing and transportation director now, and yeah, I've been working with Welcoming Neighbors Network on pro-housing policy, but very much within the context of this environmental advocacy organization. And so framing it, I have framed this work for Mountain True very much as making a climate case for building more housing in the right places. And that has been a really interesting space to occupy because a lot of stuff comes up within that realm that we're going to get into. But yeah, that's sort of how I got here.
I love that. I think Mountain True might be the only or one of a few that I think start it, members in the Welcoming Neighbors Network, that is, that started as environmental orgs and then tacked on housing. A lot of our members are like housing orgs that obviously view the environment as a concern, and that's part of our general belief on housing, like why we care about housing is the environmental concern and the climate concern. But y'all started as that and then moved in, and now especially in this recent bit of reform you've worked to get through, it's not just environment, it's not just housing as a market device, like it's racial justice and dealing with historic patterns in your own communities too. So like, no small task. So super casual.
Cakewalk. I can solve all those problems.
Right. Yeah. You're like, I just cared about the environment, and now here I am, like, how do I right centuries of wrongs for my entire country? Very casual. But yeah, and I want to hear all about that. Of course, as we get there. And but before that, do you have a sense, this came up in a couple of prior interviews on this podcast about the purpose or the function of having a really strong understanding of your why, like the thing that motivates you. Do you have something like that that guides you, that succinct or otherwise, that is like the thing you point to?
It's a good question, and I feel like I've seen this question come up before in stuff that I've worked with you on, like forms I was maybe supposed to fill out and probably didn't, because I'm like, well, let's just talk about it. Let me just easier for me to explain. But I think sort of who I am is very like strong. I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but like I have a strong sort of like force of person that is very anchored in my own sense of like moral compass and integrity and authenticity and honoring relationship and stuff like that, and that guides how I move through the world. But I've never been motivated enough to put it into like, here's the phrase that I use to describe my why. Aside from what I was saying earlier about like wanting to mitigate the suffering of people around me, like just so much pain in the world, and that really sits with me and weighs on me in a way that I don't like. And so I am always trying to find either volunteer roles or professional opportunities or just ways to use my time to try and relieve some of that. Yeah.
No, that makes total sense. I think I'm very like very type A and like have to write everything down, and like it's ridiculous. I'm over the top with it. But you so get a glimpse into someone's why, their purpose, just seeing them work. And I've had the really great privilege of seeing your work fairly closely, as close as I can be from Austin to Asheville, over the last, year and a half. And you're right. You're a force of nature. It's very apparent what you value, and I think that you bring that very clearly into the conversations. I mean, some internal you know this better than anyone, like internal debates over those kind of values questions are huge. And you were navigating that in this recent set of policy victories in the end. I want to hear about what you got done, because it was like a lot. And then, like, let's dig into the process, because you just have so much to offer us all in that. So, what first off, what did you do?
Well, first off, thank you. I'm always very flattered by the kind things that you guys say about me. And I'm like, oh, I love the Welcoming Neighbors Network. Yeah, so Asheville, the city of Asheville, earlier this month passed five different changes to our unified development ordinances. So three of them had to do with existing commercial districts, and I framed it as being on our main transportation corridors or transit corridors. Because that, to me, as an environmental advocate, is like the best place to add more homes so that people could walk and bike and take the bus to get around. And we want to build our cities and towns like in and up rather than sprawling across our landscape. So these three changes allow for greater residential density on our main transportation corridors. The first one was eliminated parking requirements for any building in these commercial and I suppose I should caveat, like each of these different proposals affected different definitions of like commercial districts, but outside of Asheville, I don't think anyone's really going to care. But like if someone digs into it, there are separate little maps for like which parcels are affected by which of these things. Eliminated parking requirements. The second one increased allowable heights for buildings if they included residential components. So if it was a, Sam's Club or like a storage unit thing, then it doesn't get any extra height bonus. But if it is apartments or condos or residential, then it can be, I forget, two or three stories taller. And then the third one changed the levels or the thresholds for review such that larger scale housing projects or mixed use projects could get approved at the staff administrative level, rather than having to go all the way to city council to get the approvals for the permits and building permits and such, which is huge because that adds such a hurdle and a burden to the process of getting housing built to have to get the political will of one's elected officials to like give it their blessing. So those three things combined, we are really excited might open up a lot of opportunity for additional housing on our transit corridors. The other two, the last two of the five, affected our residential neighborhoods and were more sort of broadly applicable. And that changed the rules around how easy it is to build on what are called flag lots. So flag lots are essentially like being able to subdivide your property and build another house behind the primary house on a parcel. And the shape of that lot, like you have to have a little strip of land adjacent to your house that like meets the street, and then there's like a bigger square in the back, and that, if you're looking at it on a map from above, looks like a flag. So easier to build those now. And cottage developments, which are like a cluster of three or five or six homes around a common shared green space. Those types of developments are now also easier to build in more places in the city. Those two proposals, well, I don't know how much detail we want to get into, but came through a different process rather than the city staff initiating some changes to the UDO. Those two came from a developer in town, but who has been leading the city's affordable housing committee for a very long time, is really interested in building more affordable housing. And so he wanted to change those rules because his company does that kind of development. And he was just really aware of that hurdle. But by it having not come sort of from staff initially, it came from sort of an outside like resident citizen, that complicated a bunch of things. The city staff was trying to just make changes on our transportation corridors and in our commercial districts first, because of the concerns and opposition that they knew was coming from what in Asheville, we are calling our legacy neighborhoods, which are mostly our historically Black neighborhoods, but it's a coalition that includes a largely Latino community sort of on the edges of town. And so collectively, I'm not sure who came up with the name, but they're called the Legacy Neighborhood Coalition. And those groups are especially vulnerable in some ways to gentrification and displacement. And so they fear that some changes to that will make it easier to build homes in their neighborhoods might accelerate that process and push them out. And so there was a lot of backlash from those groups about these proposed changes that came from this developer. And so it was a little tricky to try and frame this for the public of like, we really want the things on the corridors. We also like these policies that are going to affect neighborhoods, but ideally, those would have sort of come in a later phase of what is looking like it's going to be a year or two of other changes to our development ordinances, because the city staff and city council are working with that Legacy Neighborhood Coalition to try and get some like protections or something in place where they can feel like they have some more assurances that they're not going to get pushed out of this community. And then they hopefully will be more welcome to changes to the zoning ordinances and whatnot when they feel like, okay, I don't have to fear that I'm going to have to leave here. So the city is working on, building those relationships and navigating that complicated space. And this whole set kind of included both of those two things, but that got a little tricky.
Yeah, I'm sure. All of those things can be tricky. Having fought some of them here in Austin, hopefully, more of them as we go forward in the future here. But those legacy neighborhoods have a real hard-learned skepticism of development rules, right? Like it's not like they're just, NIMBY or whatever we want to label them. Like their communities have been systemically excluded from the halls of power and been, I mean, Austin is a great example. On our east side, they've borne the brunt of development quite a bit. So I understand that the skepticism there. As you were approaching this, because I know from seeing you work, how deeply you actually care about those concerns. And you have also this strong sense of like what evidence shows will make housing more affordable in your community. Meeting those two things is quite a task. How did you think through that?
I mean, gosh, I felt different on different days, because it is so complex and layered. But I guess what I'll respond to first is like I completely agree with you. Those neighborhoods, I mean, our historically black neighborhoods have been so under attack, specifically by like planning, zoning, ordinances, policies historically in this country. So it is no surprise or no like mystery why those communities would not trust, white developers coming in and saying, if we change all these rules that you don't understand because housing policy is complicated and I'll get out, like, it's gonna make it better for you. And they're like, since when is that how that works, right? Like, so I guess, I have enough knowledge of that history to have a lot of empathy and compassion for where those groups are coming from. And Asheville, like many cities, is a desirable place to live in this country, and therefore housing is super expensive and it's competitive to get it. And we're a tourist-driven economy. A ton of people visit here and then they're like, oh, this place is delightful. I would like to live here, and it's like, cool, you just tried to move in here with your billions of dollars that you earned somewhere else, and there's like no jobs here. I mean, so it's just it is a tight market. And I feel for the folks who have been here for a long time and have borne the brunt of bad policy in the past, and fear potential outcomes that could continue to be specifically devastating to their communities. So I think I'd say that's sort of where I'm initially coming from in honoring those concerns. And then, I mean, in the last couple of years, I have learned a lot about the benefits of adding housing supply and increasing our options for housing and building more smaller homes that are in places that are where walking distance or transit options, where you can get around and your quality of life can be better, but your cost of living, if your transportation costs go down, makes a huge difference as well. So wanting to be able to make it easier to get more homes in those places, makes a lot of sense to me. And just the more I have learned about it, the more I want those options to be available to people. So holding both of those, knowledge sets or whatever, I think is what kind of grounds me in then navigating the conversations and the relationships and the points of tension and the funky, weird dynamics that pop up when you get into kind of the nitty-gritty of policy advocacy, policy like making, trying to I thought this was interesting. Just like the complexity of writing code is a thing that I am like relatively new to. And so the city staff at some point was like, well, we don't have a way to reference in the code the boundaries of these legacy neighborhoods. So like we would like to be able to say this policy will impact the rest of the city, but not in that neighborhood. But there's no way to like define that in the code. So what they ended up doing on the two amendments that affected neighborhoods, the flag lots and the cottage courts, is they individually listed every parcel, every lot in those neighborhoods has a number on some, like whatever deed in the magistrate's office, and they like listed every single one of them as the way to like carve them out from these policies. Isn't
That is actually crazy. That
that
is so
wild? I
much.
mean, like, I didn't see that because that happened sort of behind the scenes, but like they talked about that. And I'm like, that must be pages of code that they have just added to our like already epically long development regulations. So anyway, stuff gets complicated and gets interesting and funky, and holding those other two sort of, things for me around the history of displacement and discrimination against Black and brown people in this country, and then also like a confidence that adding more housing in our communities should help people be able to stay here and live affordably is, yeah, really helpful for me.
Yeah, and part of the reason I ask at the onset of every one of the episodes of The Stoop about the guests why is because that grounds everything we do, whether or not we say it out loud, right? Which you have a conscious understanding of your purpose, not stated in one sentence, but you have that understanding. And if we're careless about what that is, then we end up doing things that hurt our neighbors, hurt our coalition partners, hurt our cause, etc. And that's part of what was so interesting to me looking at how this unfolded with you and Asheville and everything, because it feels like your value commitments were strong enough to withstand the storm that came, right? Like when shit hit the fan, you were still a trusted voice and you had earned that trust, right? Like, trust is not just willy-nilly. I mean, as much as we'd like to think we go up to someone on the street and we trust them until they're proven we shouldn't, that's not how it works, right? It's earned from the ground up. And that's part of why I try to center that in the podcast, but especially in your case, I think it seems like that really, really came to bear, 'cause correct me if I'm wrong and feel free to fill in the gaps here, but it seemed like there was stuff where legacy neighborhoods or representatives of those legacy neighborhoods were unhappy with the process by which this all came to council.
Yeah, which was fair because the process was crap. Like, we didn't need
Yeah.
all of that, but like they were right. It was bad.
Yeah. And but you still had to get up and be like, you're like, well, I know these policies work and I've been working for these things. What do I do when there's a good policy on the docket that got here through means I would never have chosen, and people could be really upset at me for saying I still like them in this circumstance? Like, how did you do that? Because that scares the shit out of me just thinking of it. If I was in your shoes, I'd be a hot mess emotionally, more than I already am.
Well, I mean, I was a hot mess, as my coworkers, my partner, my friends like might tell you. And it was interesting, like after the vote, I mean, I kind of think it took me a couple weeks emotionally to like unwind, which I didn't expect. And I kept being like, I thought winning would feel better because I felt terrible. But it had been so stressful in the build up to it, in the run up to it. So, I forgot your question. I got distracted.
Oh, it's okay. No, it's I it wasn't even clearly stated as a good question, so don't worry. Blame's on me as the host of this conversation. But I'm wondering how you managed those emotions and chose the path that you did, which was to stand in front of council and advocate for the policies and also acknowledge to the people sitting with you in the room that the process was inadequate. Like, how did you get there? Because
Yeah.
and that's why I said I was terrified. I was like, I'm making that decision. And I mean, I know talking to you like during the process and after, like those are big feelings. And I just want to affirm too that like if you win and it feels just good, you probably ignored a lot of people on the way that you shouldn't have, right? Like there, it's complicated and messy. And if you're not feeling the mess, you've got blinders on. So I feel like that's a hallmark of you doing this right.
That's really interesting, and it's really good to hear, but it's also like,
You're like, but
that's
still,
it.
yeah, right.
I want the next one to feel better like immediately,
Yeah.
Cutter. Yeah, I mean, how did I get to it? Like, it matters to me. So I think one of the things that helps me earn people's trust is that I tend to be incredibly honest and like transparent and authentic, like to a fault. There are times my supervisor Chris Joyelle, who will unsurprisingly come up in this conversation because he and I dealt with a lot of this tension leading up to this thing. But in my performance review this year, he said something like, "Your honesty, frankly, is sometimes obnoxious." And I was like, "Yeah, I know. I'm sorry." I don't envy you managing me. It's not easy. And yet that like I just sort of bring and am like my sort of authentic self, for better or worse, because sometimes it's a problem. But like that's just sort of like how I show up in the world. And I think that people see that and they recognize that they can trust what I'm saying, you know, even if we disagree or whatever. Like, I don't think people are questioning my motives or my intentions or whatever. So I think that that is helpful. And I have, over the last couple of years, built a lot of relationships with various partners who are either on the affordable housing side of things in Asheville, or I mean, I've tried to build relationships with members of these legacy neighborhoods and representatives of those like neighborhood associations. That is not always easy because, you know, that history of mistrust among those demographics for white-led nonprofits coming in and being like, "We understand this policy and here's why you should get on board." Like, there's a lot of that in the room, and I get that. But trying to show up and sort of brace that anyway and like, you know, be like, "Yeah, I get why you wouldn't trust me. I'm gonna hang out here anyway, and let's see if we can get to know each other and get to a different place." You know, you got to be willing to do some of that too. And then, I mean, a third element of this, which I don't think we've gotten into much yet here, but was in this particular case, like leading up to what I was gonna say in front of counsel or sort of how I would lead or frame any of sort of the organizing, grassroots organizing that we would do in advance to try and get other members of the public to speak in support of these amendments, like the environmental concerns, like, and not even like it wasn't so much the environmental concerns, but like working with the internal dynamics of our organization that has different like alliances, different relationships with other partners, and trying to earn the confidence of my leadership, my boss, my fellow staff to be like, "Guys, this is a super thorny and complicated thing, and like trust me to like be able to speak from a place of compassion and understanding and like nuance, that isn't gonna like burn any bridges down or like, you know, I don't know, explode." Because, you know, people have a lot of feelings about their housing security, and reasonably so. And so it is a scary thing to take a hard position on a controversial issue and fear like, where's the backlash going to come from people who don't agree with this thing?
Could we jump in there a little bit? I if you're cool going there, because I think this is like an understated part of the work, especially as things institutionalize and professionalize. You mentioned Chris, and I love Chris. I adore Chris. I love your whole team. All of you are so different. It's so funny. But it was I remember sitting in a call with before, like the week before this wind happened, and I was in Mexico City, like in this like taxi, taking this call, and the mood was shifting so quickly week to week because nobody was sure when it was going to happen, how the votes were going to fall, whatever else. And that week, I remember being like, oh no, what's happened? Because y'all were having some serious conversations about how to navigate these values. And we talk a lot about this in the external coalitions, right? Like, I think every episode of this podcast, we've talked about how you manage that with a coalition partner. Mountain True being an explicitly environmental organization and then being in this context where there is the skepticism from legacy neighborhoods who have a strong voice and an earned seat at that table, thank God, you're having to navigate this even internally, and that's really freaking hard. Like, it's so much easier to be like, that group over there doesn't agree with me. Okay, we'll work to get there, or sometimes we won't. You're having to have this conversation with the people who say yes or no to whether you can go out into the world and do this work. And I think wonderfully, and I think the thing that keeps it together to me is, again, y'all are like agreed on the values. Like, there was never a moment in any of those tough conversations that I can recall where any of you were like, well, I think you just don't value housing enough, or I think you just don't care enough about legacy or whatever. Never the case. Like, y'all were all bought in on it. It was how those values got expressed in this context. Can you help? I mean, I'm asking for myself as much for any listener, because I've been in these contexts, not so much at Welcoming Neighbors, but in prior workplaces, especially. How do you navigate that? Because that's hard. That's really freaking hard.
It's super hard. It's super hard, and it was really stressful. And so the most heat in there was between me and Chris. Chris is my boss, and he and I have a great relationship. We have worked together for, I don't know, 6 or 6, 7 years, something like that. And he's been my boss for like two of those, maybe. And I was working for the organization before he came to the organization, so like the sort of initial dynamic that we had was he was like, I'm new here, Susan, like how do you do this thing, where do I find this, like what is this policy about, you know? And so I kind of felt like I was sort of his boss before he became my boss, because I was like, I can answer your questions and like I can help orient you to this place. He also, our personalities are very different. I am an Enneagram 8. I like go with my gut. I like make decisions, and then I like charge after the thing that I've decided is the right thing. And Chris is a lot more like, I want to gather more information. I want to talk to more people. I want to, you know, be really sure that the path that we are choosing is the right path before we, you know, say something we'll regret or upset somebody or whatever. Those two different approaches to work bump into each other a lot. And so we have, you know, a history of like laughing with each other in the moments where he's like, Susan, you haven't asked enough questions, or like, you need to go talk to this other person. And I'm like, I'm tired of doing all of that. Like, I know what we should do. Let's just do it. You know, like luckily he and I have been in that space enough that like we can respect one another and sort of work through some of these things. But in this context, it was more heated because Chris has a much deeper and longer history of relationship with, in particular, one of the legacy neighborhood like representatives, or the one of the neighborhoods within that coalition. He has worked with the IMA community on a bunch of different projects, including a community plan that laid out, you know, policy goals for anti-displacement that would help them have more housing security and whatnot. And like, since that coalition really didn't want these policies to be approved in the way that it looked like they were getting drafted, which again, the process was trash. And so it wasn't clear exactly how it was going to work until like the night of the vote. And then there were maps appearing on a screen that no one in the public had seen until right then. That was stressful and not good policy making process. You know, so they had reasons to be skeptical and have concerns and to want to delay the votes in order to better understand what the implications were and where the, you know, changes were going to start and stop and whatnot. And there's also a lot of, urgency from the pro-housing activists in Asheville who are coming from different, partner organizations or groups, who for a number of years have been sort of increasing the, I don't know, sense of urgency or the, volume behind the, like, we need more housing options and we needed them yesterday. Like, you have got city council to, like, change these rules to make it easier for us to be able to afford to live here. So that sense of urgency had been like really ramping up, and that is coming into conflict with the Legacy Neighborhood saying like, whoa, 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 we are perhaps the most vulnerable, piece of this community. Like, give us some more time to understand it and to advocate for our own needs and concerns. And the process wasn't really allowing for that. I should also add, like, Asheville just went through a horrific natural disaster back in the fall, and that really jacked up a lot of the process too, because so much of the sort of effort and energy and like relationship building that staff and Legacy Neighborhood members and activists had been doing really all got kind of hijacked for months because storm response became the name of the game. So, trying to also hold empathy for the fact that like stuff got messy, in part because it wasn't anybody's fault, but like trying to deal with a natural disaster and also solve these big problems is hard. Understatement. But so Chris was really nervous, and understandably so, about the risks to his relationship with this neighborhood and didn't want our sense of urgency on wanting better housing policy to override or sort of overpower or whatever, ruin potentially that those relationships. And I got that. I could hear, I understood where he was coming from on that. At the same time, I was pretty sure that we as an organization could say, here's why we think these policies are good and why we like them. We also council staff, like, ask you to do the best that you can in, changing the map on the fly and whatever to honor and respect and respond to the specific requests that this coalition of neighborhoods has made around, delaying implementation of some of these changes in their neighborhoods. And I felt like that was sort of the best that we could do to kind of walk this thin line where I wanted to stand alongside our existing partners and hopefully potential future partners within these legacy neighborhoods and say, like, hey, we're with you. We hear that you have concerns. We want to honor those. We want these policies to respect those. And also pro-housing advocates, like, we agree. Like, we need to change these rules and we need to get more housing here. And that to me felt possible. But it was clearly scary for Chris to just trust me to figure out sort of how to say that from the podium when, like, maybe whatever maps or like carve outs or, changes they made to the policy had probably just happened that night, So he and I were really kind of back and forth on whether I could speak from the podium at all, whether I could represent the organization when I did that, what I would say. I mean, it was hard for the organization to sort of collectively decide, yeah, here's going to be our position on this thing when there wasn't enough clarity on what the thing was going to be. So yeah, that was really stressful. And, circling back to sort of my, like, why, if you want to frame it that way, like, I really felt like it mattered. And it was interesting grappling with this myself and talking to other people about it, like, to what degree is that hubris? Like, to what, is it really going to make a difference to council if I, Susan Bean, like, speak from the podium in public comment alongside, like, 20 other public speakers, right? Like, I'm not the one voting. I don't represent, like, I mean, whatever, our organization has a reputation, but like, at the end of the day, did it matter? Like, I could have just sat in the audience and not said anything and probably would have had the same outcome. But to me, it felt like it mattered, right? Like, I had been doing public education and building these partnerships and putting on events and like meeting with city council people and trying to like bring people around to supporting these kinds of changes to get the housing that I thought we needed and also trying to honor and respect the legacy neighborhood concerns in this process. it felt, I just felt like I would be such a chicken shit if I sat on the sidelines when it, when the, you know, came down to it and didn't stand up for what I thought was right and voice that, even though it was contentious and tricky. So I felt like I needed to do that. And I do feel like that mattered. Interestingly, I had a finally got a drink with one of the council members this past week who I've been working closely with on this stuff for a couple of years. And because I wanted to celebrate. I'm like, do we get to like enjoy this and say like we did a really good thing? Like this was hard and we passed it, whatever. And one thing she said to me, which I just really appreciated, was like, you know, thank you so much for doing this work. Like Mountain True, as an environmental organization whose, you know, mission has not been pro-housing policy for the 40 years it's been in existence, you know, there's a big learning curve there for this organization to come around on supporting development, historically environmentalists oppose development. That's just like, you know, part of the fabric of environmentalism. And yet it's a new world and climate change is a different reality. And so like helping bring our supporters, our donors, our partners like along in understanding how we need a different approach as environmentalists to how development can happen, where it should happen, you know, what are the rules and the parameters around that? Bringing them along is not easy and yet is so needed. And so she was like, thank you so much for that work because, you know, if Mountain True or if environmentalism or this movement or the people in our community who share those same values, can't figure it out and support and get behind the council members who are the ones who have to make the hard vote and, you know, make the statement that people are actually going to like quote in the paper, right? Like if they don't have people behind them, they can't do that hard thing, right? And so the work of, you know, an organizer or a policy advocate or whatever, it is to help bring others along and get them behind the people who are going to have to make the hard decision. Some of the people who are going to make the hard decision ideally make the right one and keep making the right one because there's a bunch more hard decisions coming. And so it just meant so much to hear from one of those policymakers, like, hey, that work that you did mattered, you know? And that's probably not like, thanks for standing up on, at the podium and saying whatever you said. Like, that's a small piece of it. But the months and years of work leading up to that, of helping sort of frame this issue in a different and new way for our organization and try and make it make sense to our partners. And, you know, there were various successes and failures along the way on that. But for her to say that that work mattered to her really, really mattered a lot to me.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have feedback like that because it like reassures that it does matter to us. I mean, like you said, you're like, would it really make a difference if I was standing up there or not? And the answer is yes. And like, it doesn't feel like it when you're like, who am I standing before city council who actually holds the power to like, is it going to do anything? Is it already written in the cards? But it does matter, and not just in the sense of giving them political cover, which is kind of the pessimistic way of viewing a lot of the stuff that you see this in state houses and city halls all over the country, where they're like, oh, well, if we have these groups behind them, they have the political cover to say, well, look, the environmentalists are behind them, whatever. That's sure, but really, what it is it signifies that it signifies an identity of someone who cares about the environment or who cares about housing. I'm a pro-housing activist. I'm an environmentalist. I'm a whatever. And that looks like X, Y, and Z. And so when you're standing up there with Mountain True, you're saying just by standing, this is what an environmentalist looks like in today's context. You can't be in this, you're on the front lines of like every kind of big movement that we had progressive winds on in the 20th century coming to reckon with what's in the 21st, right? It's like, oh, we can't just be anti as environmentalists, you know, we have to be pro something. I mean, the whole abundance agenda that's being talked about with the new book by Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson, and it's in all the news and yada yada yada. It's all this reckoning with like the progressivism of the last era doesn't suit the new one, and it unfortunately, sometimes got in the way in ways we didn't predict. Housing being a great example, right? Like all the veto points and layers of regulation and all this other stuff that gets in the way of us building. We're now like, it's not progressive if that keeps people priced out or makes our communities exclusively of one race, class, etc. And you're having to do that in real time, which is, again, no small task. But part
yeah,
of
I mean, I feel like I wandered off there, but like that question of like whether I would speak from the podium, I mean, like it really was hard for me and Chris to figure that out because he didn't want to burn bridges with this neighborhood. He didn't want to ruin that relationship that really mattered. And I didn't either, right? Like, and I needed to convince him of that. I'm like, yes, no, I care about both of these things, which, you know, he knows, but also like when the process is crap and you don't know what the policy is going to be, then at the end of the day, he kind of had to just trust me to like figure it out a little bit on the fly. And that's a scary thing for an employer, you know, of an organization that's been around for 40 plus years. That's like newly working on an issue in a particular way. Like, so anyway, I felt for where they were coming from in having concerns about like just sending me forth. but also it was hard for me to sort of hold that line of like, no, you guys, I think this matters. I think this process has been far from perfect. These policies are not perfect. There's so many like ways that we could choose to, you know, avoid or dodge or delay this decision or taking a position on it. And yet it feels to me like we can't let perfect be the enemy of the good. And in this case, that meant like speaking up for the concerns of legacy neighborhoods, but also saying we think this policy is good enough and we support it. And we ask you, council, to support it too. And then we are in this for the long haul to like keep showing up for the, you know, future controversial votes and the other challenging, you know, they're going to get pushback from other neighborhood demographics and other parts of our community that have concerns. And like, we're going to be there to like navigate those hard lines and those difficult votes too. And it just felt like it mattered to me. It mattered to me to hold that line and demonstrate that we could do that hard thing. But yeah, that was a really contentious thing between me and my employer, who I really appreciate. Like, love Chris. He's great. We work really differently. We fight a lot, but we're like really good people who are both trying to do the same good things.
Yeah, I think that's so refreshing to see, even being in the room for some of those conversations, the virtual room again.
Yeah, right.
You know, I'm in Austin. But the virtual room for those conversations where like you two could have this conflict, but it was never existential. And like, then it would immediately be like falling back on the trust that you two had built in the shared values. And that to me, I was like, oh my gosh, this is such a model for what like coalition work can do. And that like, shit's going to hit the fan at some point everywhere. There are so many different things pulling on our attention when you're working on something as critical as where people go home to sleep at night, that you cannot avoid that. And the emotional readiness to be in conflict and to be in that tension and have the courage to move through it in whatever way is right. Like Chris had courage in saying to you, and probably the bias to take action, to say like, hold on, we got to think. And I know we care about this, and you know Chris cares about housing. So to say like, I care about this, but we have to pump the brakes a little bit. That takes courage. And then in the face of the things you care about, as well with like with the legacy neighborhoods and honoring that and wanting a better process genuinely, and still saying, but I feel like we have to stand up. Like they're both, y'all both had the courage to meet in that room. And that is what makes the difference. And so you got some things across the line now. And to me, I was like, amazing that all the things happen despite the chaos of what goes into process. But even more amazing is what this means going forward. Because the response from the some of the legacy neighborhoods folks that were in the room was pretty good to what you said, right?
Yeah, so it's a council meeting and you're not supposed to like clap or like hoot and holler or whatever, you know. So like the mayor, often when something is kind of hot and people start doing that, she has to interrupt everybody and be like, all right, we know that you're, you know, emotional about this topic or whatever. Could you like just put your hands in the air and wave your fingers? Like, I realize I'm doing this on Zoom and this is going to be a podcast and they can't see my hands, but you know, like jazz hands or whatever, like spirit fingers. As a way of showing visually your support for what a speaker has said rather than making noise to not disrupt the meeting. And so I turned around after being like, please support these policies. Also, please honor the Legacy Neighborhoods requests as much as possible. And I saw all these spirit fingers from both the pro-housing people and the Legacy Neighborhood representatives who were in the room. And that meant so much to me. That meant so much for me. Yeah, I did a lot of crying in the subsequent week, let's be honest.
Oh, that's real. That's so real. And I'm glad you're saying it out loud on a podcast. So, like, people who are like uncomfortable cry, because I'm a crier. I'm an emotional person, which is probably why we connected early on. Is I'm like, I'll cry with you, Susan. But it is such when you care about it, it hits you like that. And to see the spirit fingers is that's I'm so glad. I just feel like after navigating the process, all y'all who stood in that room deserve the spirit fingers. And that makes me really excited about what can happen next because it wasn't just drawing the ire of people who were the would-be enemies of your policy outcomes. You know, it was a chance to come together, and that's going to be an opportunity. You know, if it wasn't, it would have been a very different reaction when you turned around and you would have gone home and not felt mixed emotions. You'd have been like, oh shit, what happened? You know, like the mix is good.
Well, it was tricky then too, because like by the end of the meeting, so I mean, I was one of the earlier public comment makers, right? And then there was, a whole bunch of people who came after me, and then council voted. There was probably discussion from council. I can't quite remember the flow of that night at this point, but a lot of the public comment from various Legacy Neighborhood representatives was really oppositional and very heated and very pointed at certain council people. And I would say in large part because the process was so crappy. But also in part because, they did make requests that they didn't get all of them, right? Council tried to carve out some sections of the city map and a bunch of different parcels that wouldn't be affected by, in particular, the Flaglot and Cottage Court changes. And that was because Legacy Neighborhoods had requested those carve-outs, but they didn't get everything that they had asked to be exempted from those changes. And they were pretty upset about that. And so that was sort of like the tail end of the public comment was like pretty acrimonious, like, ugh. And so then you're walking out of the room and being like, well, I got spirit fingers, which like I feel good about because that was really hard. But like, ooh, like a lot of these people are now unhappy. Was this good? We can't cheer, but like,
Right. Could
right?
somebody please tell me the appropriate reaction right now? I'll gladly do it.
Yeah, so I just basically kind of ran away and then got and cried.
That's real. That is so real. I had one time after when I was first working in policy, I worked at this organization that had they called it a murder board, which is already like Jesus Christ. Why would you say that? And you would it was before you were gonna go give testimony anywhere, your first time. You would sit in front of several of the VPs, possibly the executive director. And this is an organization with like 100 employees, right? So, like, it's not like people you necessarily have coffee with every day. And I was 23 at the time, I think, 22, 23. And I was going to go testify before some county commissioner's court. And so I had to do a murder board. And I did it. And they throw the worst case scenario at you. Like they act like total assholes and the whole bit. And I remember leaving that and felt like I had done really the best possible job. But then I went back to my office, I closed the blinds and I turned the light off and turned my chair around and just sat there and I cried the same way. I was like, oh my God. And then I like composed myself, worked a little bit, and then I came out of my office later and was like, oh yeah, I've been real busy, you know? And then
Nothing to
somebody
see
came up.
here.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no, those aren't wet like tissues on my desk. No, don't mind that. But I remember then I saw one of the VPs who had been like a real hard ass to me in that murder board, and he was like, "Oh, you did so great. That was an incredible job." And I was like, "What do you mean?" I was like, "Then explain why I feel like shit right now." But that is like the plight of an activist. Like it's constant bargaining and compromising and knowing where your North Star is, but being like, but we have to make something real happen. And it just happens. And so I empathize with all those feelings so much because, I've been there in my own advocacy and it's real. We don't talk about it enough. We need like an emotional support group. We have like a policy support group. We need like an emotional support group.
And I feel like at the WNN convening, the name was too many. It was too long for me to ever hold. But the preceded Yimby Town, you know, the WWWNN.
Yeah, it's like a comical number of W's and N's.
Right, and people thought it was funny. I was like, I can't do this. Anyway, that event. I think the guy's name was Britt. And if he's listening, I apologize for getting your name wrong if I do. But like, I feel like he led some session or like facilitated some discussion about like, how do you take care of yourself, you know, in this context? Because like so much of this policy advocacy space is like heated and complex and there's a lot of opposition. And some people are like, you know, see this issue from one single perspective and they're like, feel all the feelings and they're going to shout about it, you know, and it's like, I hadn't at that point, I mean, I dealt with some controversial stuff, but sort of not as a like policy advocate as my job. I hadn't sort of like hit the heat of a campaign yet in that way. And I still haven't experienced a lot of the backlash that I expect we will face in Asheville as we move into more changes within neighborhoods. Like I do think there's going to be more broad opposition that we will have to deal with. But anyway, it was just interesting. So I feel like there are other people naming that and trying to create space for shared, like, God, let's all commiserate and let's like give each other some like pats on the back and like, I don't know what we need to just like recover and also like to have the fortitude to do it again. So I don't know. I'm grateful for like Brit and other folks who are trying to name that and do that because you're right. We need it. And it's really hard. And if you're not like, I don't know, it's important to sort of share that with the other people who are in the same place and navigating those same things.
Yeah, for sure. There's a different kind of understanding when you've been through it. Well, we're coming up on our hour here somehow already. Floor is yours. Is there anything you want to share about your win, about what's next, what you're excited about, or anything just in general? It's the Susan Bean show right now.
Oh, God. I don't know. One thing that someone was saying recently that I thought was really interesting, because like I was really struck by how winning didn't feel as good as I thought it would feel or wanted it to feel. And I was having coffee with a friend of mine recently, or well, no, let's be honest, chocolate cake. So I was like, listen, we won. I want chocolate cake. This guy's been doing housing advocacy in Asheville for a long time and has been really helpful to me in understanding complexities and nuance and the issue and the people involved and whatnot. Anyway, he was talking about like the framing of everything as a fight, you know, that these campaigns and advocacy, it's like you do need to call things wins. There's importance to that in sort of building a movement and like gaining, making advances as a movement. And yet the framing of everything as being a battle and like you either win or you lose and you have to sort of define it as one or the other when like the reality is it's so much more complex and there were compromises and there was stuff that didn't feel good and there was stuff that like should have been done way better. And it's hard to come out of that and just like put on a big smiley face and call it a win. But you also want to be like, but I did work really hard for this. And I think it was the best of the options. But I don't know. There's so many other options. There's like infinite options, right? So like, maybe it wasn't. There's just like so much doubt and so many swirling emotions in there. But I just appreciated that the prospect for like, for myself kind of continuing in this work of thinking of it as less of a sort of battleground with each thing being either a win or a loss, like trying to sort of hold in my head, I don't know, the richness of it, the complexity of it. That's like, it's kind of going to be both, you know? And so that I think thinking of it in that way allowed me a little more room and grace for like all the swirling emotions that I was feeling in the aftermath. And I think that that will be helpful for me going forward too. It's like, even though that, there's good reasons to frame it as a fight and to call it a win and or even a loss sometimes, and there's reasons to do that too, but the reality is that it's not that clean. It's not that simple. And I think I knew that, but thinking about it in the aftermath of a vote, because there is a very specific, like, it either went one way or it went the other way, because people had to say yes or no, and like it seems so clear cut. I don't know. I appreciated thinking of it differently, in that context.
Yeah, that's big. That's big. I always think of it mostly metaphorically, but also not totally metaphorically. It's like when you know it up front in your brain versus when it moves back into your brain, and that's a different thing. Like up front, I know it's going to be messy. I know we're going to have to, I know I've seen the playbook, you know? And then when you actually have to get it into the feelings, it's different. And you learn and you leave that with a different sort of empathy for those who went before and those in the space with you now. So I think that's huge. But yeah, I am just so eternally grateful for you and for your work. And I am so excited for Asheville. I hope one day to visit and see.
Oh
I
yeah, you should
know
come.
I need to.
We have water now.
That's great because here in the hill country in Texas, we're running out. So, but that's how it is. But yeah, just thank you. And thank you for your generosity in sharing on this podcast what you shared, because it takes a lot of courage to talk about it, period, but especially in a place where you know it'll be scrutinized and heard.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to get into it over and over again because it feels like cathartic. It's like therapy. Like, this is a lot. So like, let me, oh, you want to talk about it again? Oh, please.
Yes. So yeah, it's like collective processing. Yeah, well, I'm happy to have this space and just, yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cutter. I really appreciate it. Love working with you every time.
Yes, you too. Well, we'll talk very soon.
Okay, good deal.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
This conversation was such a beautiful one for me. I think Susan's strength of conviction and willingness to sit in the tensions that arise in our line of work without demanding easy, over-compromised resolutions or like taking a back seat to our community's real needs is critical. I'm sure you had many points like me where you thought, oh, that's real. I remember when that happened to me. And I hope, also like me, your future work can be informed by what Susan is saying here. I only wish I had had this conversation earlier. A little note here before I let you know how to reach Susan and her organization. In the episode, you heard us talk about Mountain True, which is a member of the Welcoming Neighbors Network. But in the links and handles I'm about to provide, you'll hear the name Neighbors for More Neighbors, WNC, which stands for Western North Carolina. Neighbors is a project of Mountain True, so don't be alarmed that I'm sending you to places that go by a different name than what you heard in the episode. But anyway, you can find Neighbors for More Neighbors, WNC, on social media. They are at neighbors_WNC on Instagram and on Facebook at facebook.com/neighborswnc. And that is neighbors plural for both of those. You can also go to their website, moreneighborswnc.org. To learn more about the other great work done by Mountain True, you can visit their website, of course, at mountaintrue.org. As always, you can connect with the Welcoming Neighbors Network online at welcomingneighbors.us and on social media. We are at WNN Pro Housing on Instagram and at welcomingneighbors.us on Blue Sky. The Stoop is produced in-house at the Welcoming Neighbors Network by me, Cutter Gonzalez. The music for our show was created by my friend Nolan Hopkins. If you have ideas for our show, including special episodes, guests you'd like to hear from, or topics you'd like to cover, shoot me an email at cutter@welcomingneighbors.us or DM me on social media. My handle is @CutterWGonzalez across all platforms. Thanks so much for joining us. Talk to y'all real soon.